Hello.
Salam.
Namaste.
Saliwanan.
Hujambo.
Mbote.
Konnichiwa.
Hi.
Yes.
You're listening to Crowd Science on the BBC World Service. The show that takes questions from people all over the world and finds experts who can give you the best answers. We investigate everything from hurricanes to laughter.
Tutkimme kaikkea hirmumyrskyistä.
Today, the subject is language.
Ine, glossa.
Uliimi.
Kieli.
Kengotes.
Iwiaif.
Luga.
Bhashache.
I'm Anand Jagatia, and if you could understand all of that, then well done. Although, between you and me, no one likes the smarty pants. You've just heard a medley that included Finnish, Japanese, Swahili, Welsh, and the language I grew up speaking, Gujarati. In this edition of Crowd Science, we're investigating how all of these languages came to be in the first place, thanks to a question from one of our multilingual listeners.
Hi Crowd Science, I'm BK and I live in the Philippines. Where I live, there's a different language spoken on almost every island. I speak three languages myself, Bisaya, Filipino, and English. But why wouldn't we all have just one language? Surely a language can only work if it is understood by multiple different people. How can new languages be created out of nowhere? So that's my question for Crowd Science. How does a language begin? And why do we have so many of them?
Cultures around the globe have their own creation myths to explain why we don't all talk the same talk. In the story of the Tower of Babel in the Bible, the world's people originally spoke a single language, and together they planned to build a tower that reached all the way up to the heavens. But God, the story goes, quickly put a stop to this, confusing their unified language into many separate ones. Unable to understand each other, he scattered them across the face of the earth. Today, linguists are still interested in whether the incredible diversity of modern languages can be traced back to a single origin, and how they changed along the way. So, just how many languages are spoken around the world right now?
Yes, there are some number over 7,000.
This is Dan Everett, a trustee professor of cognitive sciences at Bentley University in Massachusetts in the US.
I spent 30 years working in the Amazon on over a dozen languages, but I lived for almost 8 full years among the Pitaha, a language that had not been studied carefully before. Pitaha is also what we call a language isolate, which means it's not related to any other living language.
So our questioner for this episode wants to know how and why new languages form, how they start.
By and large, languages arise because of culturally accentuated separation. That's why when you go to Europe, Europe's a great case study, because every time you come to a major river or a major mountain range, it's almost always the case that on the other side is another language, because they stop talking to each other because of that river. So languages develop from a simple principle, which is you talk like who you talk with. If you're talking with people, you talk like them, and your language is the same. But as soon as you stop talking to those people, either for reasons of geography or reasons of economics or reasons of age, you start to talk less like them. So if we look at somebody my age and compare their speech to someone 15, we'll find a lot of differences. And I probably could not understand all of the speech of a 15-year-old American English speaker, even though we supposedly speak the same language, because we're not talking with each other. So language change is gradual, and it's caused by physical isolation, cultural isolation, generational isolation, and Europe is a great place to see this.
Do we know anything, Dan, about how quickly languages kind of diverge from each other? I know a little bit of Hindi because it's similar to Gujarati, which is the language spoken in Gujarat in India, where my family comes from, but Gujarati doesn't really help me speak Russian, right? Those languages are just mutually unintelligible. So how long does it take for one language to kind of split into two and then for them to change so much that they're separate like that?
It takes a couple of hundred years for these kinds of differences with no contact or very little contact to really solidify so that we no longer can understand the language. 6,000 years ago, most of the languages of Europe were one single language, Indo-European. so that English and German and French and Italian were all the same language back then. It's the breakups of war. It is the breakups of geography and history that have isolated groups so that they're no longer talking with each other, and therefore they no longer talk like each other. And this is the origin of all languages today. And so, for example, up until what's called in the United States the Revolutionary War, the War of Independence from Britain, British English and American English were just the same language. After they became independent countries, British vowels changed. There's something called the Great Vowel Shift. But that did not happen in American English. So if you take the word B-A-T-H, which Americans pronounce bath, and British speakers of English pronounce as both, actually the older pronunciation is the American pronunciation, because a became a after this great vowel shift. And so one of the reasons that the vowels of British English are different from the vowels of American English is because after they became separate political entities and they had less contact, there were some sound changes that happened in British English. But we talk alike because we still talk with each other. If there had been no interaction between British speakers and American speakers, the languages would probably not even be intelligible today. But we have movies, we have television, so our languages, our dialects, have not moved that far apart.
So we talk like who we talk with. Just think of the way teenagers use slang with each other. Phrases like I'm dead and spill the tea will mean very different things to my 60-year-old mum and to my little brother. And by the way, if you don't know what those terms mean, ask a young person. Because of what Dan calls culturally accentuated separation, as geographical and social forces have dispersed people around the globe, the languages spoken by these groups have slowly diverged into the 7,000 or so that we find on Earth today. To me, this description of how languages evolve over time, splitting off from each other and slowly changing, sounds a bit like the way biological populations evolve. So, are there any similarities?
The basic principle behind genetic evolution and language evolution, I think, is the same, and Darwin recognized that. He actually used language as an example to bolster his case for evolution being plausible in the biological world.
This is Quentin Atkinson, professor of psychology at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. He studies the link between linguistic and biological evolution and how languages change as people have moved across the world.
One pattern that's really striking when you look at human genetic diversity is that the amount of diversity you see declines the further you get from Africa.
The reason for this is that when humans left Africa and moved around the world, as each group broke away from their parent population, they only carried a small part of the original gene pool with them. And when another group split off from this one in turn, perhaps venturing into new, unexplored territory, it took an even smaller bit of the gene pool with it. This means that the genes of human populations today become less diverse the further you get from our ancestral population in Africa. And it turns out that something very similar happens with our language.
Now, we don't have genes of language, but we have different features in languages. And one of the features that I got interested in was the number of phonemes in a language.
A phoneme is a small unit of sound, like p, th, a, s, sh, e. These are the building blocks of all languages.
I got to thinking, well, what if it's possible to lose phonemes in a way that's analogous to the founder effect that we see in biology.
So is that what we see then, that languages tend to contain fewer of these sounds when they split off from each other?
Yeah, so that's exactly what we see. We can look at a big sample of languages from all around the world and the number of phonemes in those languages. And when you do that, the general trend is that diversity is highest in Africa and decreases the further you get from Africa. Some of the languages in Africa, particularly the Click languages, can have dozens and dozens of consonants. Some of the lowest diversity is in the Americas, or Southern America, and in the far reaches of the Pacific, including in New Zealand, where I am. Maori has relatively few phonemes. It's just half a dozen.
So we actually did another episode of Crowd Science called Where Was the Last Place Humans Made Home? And we tried to track where humans had travelled. And one of the last places they got to was New Zealand. And so what you're saying is that on average, the journey that it's, the length of the journey that humans have taken out of Africa is kind of, we kind of see that's mirrored in the way that their languages change as well, the number of phonemes that they have.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a good reason to think it'd be a particularly pronounced effect across the Pacific, because you really do have these tiny founder populations that are making these amazing oceanic voyages in canoes.
So as humans move out of Africa and populations split off from each other, their gene pool becomes smaller. In the same way, the number of sounds in their languages also tends to get smaller, perhaps because when new groups form, they don't take all of the original sounds in the language with them. This pattern doesn't mean that languages further away from Africa are simpler or less expressive, but on average, they do contain fewer individual sounds.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you was, how far can you trace languages backwards in time to see, like, what the first... I mean, could, is there any way we can use current languages and how languages change today to see what, like, the first languages would have been like and when they existed?
That is a kind of $6 million question in historical linguistics. How far back can you go? It's pretty clear you can go back several thousand years. At least 6,000 years is kind of accepted by, I think, all historical linguists. It becomes more controversial going back beyond that, 8,000 to 10,000 years. And most historical linguists think beyond the kind of 8,000 to 10,000 year period, it gets very hard to show that two languages might be related, because there's just so much change that's accumulated that it can be difficult to spot similarities.
So we can't trace modern languages back all the way to some original ancestral tongue. We don't know exactly when language itself first arose, as it doesn't leave any traces in the fossil record. Some researchers think it could be as recently as 50,000 years ago, while others, like Dan Everett, think it was much, much earlier. He's written a book called How Language Began.
First humans appeared about 2 million years ago with Homo erectus. Our species, Homo sapiens, started about 250 to 300,000 years ago, and Neanderthals about 150 to 200,000 years before that. So erectus was around for more than a million years before Neanderthals or sapiens came about, and the evidence is that they were the first to invent symbols, and with the invention of symbols by a culture, I argue that we have evidence that they had language. So in the theory of symbols, there are three types of signs. There are icons. These are things that just look like things. Other things, such as a photograph or your reflection in the water, or diagrams or pictures that we draw. The next are indexes. These are connected physically to the things they represent. So footprints are indexes, and smoke is an index of fire, and smell is an index of whatever you're smelling. Pointing to something is an index. But the most complex type of sign is the symbol. So the word for dog in English, D-O-G, refers to a canine, but that's just because, in a sense, all English speakers have agreed to this. In Spanish, perro refers to the same thing. In Portuguese, cachorro. In Pidahan, niopai. A dog doesn't have to sound like a dog. It's just whatever series of letters or gestures or pictures or whatever we decide to use arbitrarily or conventionally to represent something, that's a symbol.
So you would say that Homo erectus had language because they were capable of using symbols, and that they would have done that to kind of achieve lots of things over the course of the time they were around?
Yes, I think language is the greatest technological invention in human history. Every other invention that we've ever enjoyed as a species has come from language. Once we invent language, it's like inventing this marvelous tool. It would make no sense not to use it. So if we look at Homo erectus tools, these are the things that they've left behind that we can see, and we look at their evolution, we see that the tools that they made are very complex. In fact, laboratory experiments show that it would not be possible to make these tools without verbal instruction.
So Dan argues that language may have begun before our species, Homo sapiens, had even evolved, although this is something that's hotly debated in the field. We've heard how languages can form slowly over time as people get culturally separated from each other, and that languages can evolve in ways that parallel biological evolution and the human journey out of Africa. But languages can also change much more rapidly, and sometimes this is deliberate. One extreme example of this happened on an island just north of Australia.
New Guinea, in fact, is famous for having groups. It has close to 1,000 languages, which is a seventh of the world's languages total. And so you have very small speech communities, and apparently there is very widespread effort to keep them distinct on the part of the communities themselves.
This is Sally Thompson. She's a language expert from the University of Ann Arbor in Michigan in the U.S.
There's a language called Buin and a dialect called Uisai. The speakers of Uisai felt they were too similar. They wanted to distinguish themselves from the other speakers of Buin. So they took all their masculine nouns, and the language has a very elaborate, much more elaborate than in European languages, use of masculine and feminine gender distinctions. All their masculine nouns are feminine in the other dialects of Buin, and all their feminine nouns are masculine in the other dialects. They just switch the genders.
That was an easy way to just get everything to be different. You just switch every single gender.
Right. So it doesn't sound all that easy. In fact, it sounds as if it ought to be impossible.
So far, we've heard about the ways new languages can form through separation, cultural, geographical, and political. But what about the opposite, when languages collide? Sally studies one of the most striking ways this can happen, when two groups of people who don't speak the same language have to come up with a way of talking to each other. The result is a lingo that borrows words from both people, called a pidgin language.
A pidgin is a language that is nobody's native language. They arise typically in history. They are believed to have arisen mainly through trade. Historically, pidgins have been viewed as bastardized versions of the European language that provided the vocabulary and as spoken by people who are too stupid to speak the real language. This is ridiculous from a linguistic point of view. It's really easy to show that they are not derived grammatically in any way from the European languages of the slave traders, but the reputation has hung on.
The good news is that this poor reputation is changing. Millions of people around the world speak pidgins, and in 2017, the BBC started a new pidgin service for West Africa. This is one of their news reports.
Yes, so the campaign with Encore Africa Month go feature some Obonge African musicians.
I phoned up one of the BBC pidgin team in Nigeria to learn a bit more about how the language works.
My name is Daniel Semeni Worima. I am a senior broadcast journalist with the BBC Pidgin Service.
First of all, Daniel, can you say something to us in pidgin so that we can hear what it sounds like?
Anan, are you there now?
So, what does that mean?
It simply means, Anan, how are you?
Oh, how would I say, I'm good, how are you?
You can say, I day fine.
I day fine.
Then if you want to say, how are you, you can say, I day fine, how far now?
Well, how far now, Daniel?
So, I day can't pay, I day fine.
So you work for BBC Pidgin, which launched in 2017. Were you there when the service launched?
Yes, I was there. The BBC saw the potentials in communicating with this language that is not yet official in any part of West or Central Africa, but it is spoken by very many. At least 100 million people in West Central Africa. So if the BBC has found it necessary to delve into pidgin broadcasts, the possibility of making it official is highly likely.
There is obviously some English in pidgin.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit more about what Nigerian pidgin actually is?
The language we now know as Nigerian pidgin is a mixture of local dialects together with English. This dates back to the 1800s when the early explorers of Africa, from Portuguese, from the United Kingdom, tried to explore Africa. They had to communicate with the locals there. And to do so, they had to illustrate in bits and pieces of their own language and mash it with the native speaker's language. And you can now define that as Nigerian pidgin.
So pidgin is basically an artifact of colonialism. These people came over to Africa and it's the local dialects mixed up with that. And you can kind of hear traces of all of them. So can we just hear a little bit more? I was wondering if you could just say a few more things to us in pidgin just so that we can get a flavour for it.
Yeah, I could just play this audio. I asked a colleague to record for me so I can use that as an explanation.
Haba now, I know Sabi speak English.
I don't know if you get that.
Haba now, I know Sabi speak English.
Let me have a guess. Is it? So I heard the word English in there. Do you speak English? Is that?
So what you have seen here is a mixture of the native Hausa and a bit of the archaic Sabin, but we see it as now a Konk Pidgin language for no. And then the real-time English speak English. So if I say, Haba now, I know Sabi speak English. He simply meant, come on, I don't know how to speak English.
So what do linguists know about how pidgins like this one arise in the first place? How do people with no common language start to piece together a new method of communication? Here's Sally Thompson again.
Mostly what we know about that is inference, because almost all the pidgins we know of developed, 100 or more years ago, and nobody was tracing their development. But there are a couple of pidgins where linguists have actually been able to watch it happen. The most famous one is the Nicaraguan Sign Language. This is a community in Nicaragua that had a high percentage of deaf people for whatever genetic reason, but they do communicate with their siblings and their parents by gestures. What happened in Nicaragua was you had a bunch of deaf kids in different households, so isolated from each other, and then a deaf school was formed. And you got the deaf kids together, and that is how Nicaraguan Sign Language arose.
At the school, the deaf children were told they weren't allowed to use gestures and even made to place their hands flat on the table. The teachers hoped they'd learn to be able to lip-read and speak Spanish without being able to hear it. Perhaps unsurprisingly, they found this difficult. But outside of the classroom and on the playgrounds, they were busy creating their own impromptu pidgin sign language. Eventually, the adults became aware of what was happening, and for the first time, researchers were able to study how a brand new language was unfolding in front of them.
I watched a video at a showing an aunt and her nephew, both deaf. Both had been to the school, so the aunt was in the first generation, the kid was in the next one. And I don't remember the exact topic, but it was something like giving directions to go someplace. And the aunt was gesturing, or she was using her version of the sign language, but she kind of stumbled. And the kid kind of looked at her. He wasn't disrespectful, but he kind of looked at her like, you know what? What's wrong? You just do this. And then he did something obviously much more complicated, much more sophisticated, and didn't have any trouble explaining at all.
They found that as younger children had acquired this language from older kids, they'd spontaneously introduced elements of grammar, making it richer, more complex, and more expressive.
So you actually could see in this video the different levels of development of this sign language.
This is just kids spontaneously coming up with their own language and then between them systems kind of standardizing it and making it into a complete language without any other input.
Right. Yes. It's very hard to keep children from learning a language. I mean, it's really difficult. Sign language had the advantage of being created by kids because kids are better language learners than adults.
So languages can come about slowly over decades of isolation, or they can form rapidly when people are thrown together. Either way, both of these processes occur naturally without any conscious planning. But some new languages are created in a completely different way.
Tro etrib patli lalulilu ilu talululi rolun.
The poetry you're hearing now is in a language that didn't exist before 2005.
Sangari kivket rut e.
Okay, my name is Paul Frommer, and for the past few years I've been involved in language creation, and in particular creation of the Na'vi language for James Cameron's Avatar.
Avatar is the second highest-grossing movie of all time after inflation. But if you haven't seen it, it's a sci-fi film from 2009 that features beautiful blue aliens from another world called the Na'vi. The whole of the Na'vi language, from its sounds to its vocabulary and its grammar, was devised by Paul. He was trying to do something on his own that normally takes generations, and this gives us an insight into just how complex a language really has to be.
The way a linguist would construct a language is essentially to start with a sound, and once you get the basic sounds, then you want to think about syllables, what kind of sounds can fit at the end of the syllable. That enables you to put them together and construct words. And from words, you create phrases. And from phrases, you create sentences. And that sort of hierarchical structure is common to all human language. And that allows you to put things in different orders and to change things around and to use those finite elements to create really an infinite number, for all practical purposes, an infinite number of messages.
So because you were kind of free to create a totally new language,
yeah,
in some ways you could do whatever you wanted, but in other ways you had to be constrained and you had to be limited by rules that would make the language kind of consistent with what we know about what languages have to do. So right. What are some of those things that you had to kind of limit or that you had to impose on the language?
Yeah. There were quite a few constraints that the language was, in fact, learnable by human beings. Anyone could construct grammatical rules that are logical, but so bizarre that no human being would ever be able to process it in any sort of normal, automatic way. For example, I could say that in order to ask a question, you simply say the entire sentence backwards. Now, that could work logically. A computer might be able to handle it, but no human would be able to handle that spontaneously.
Okay, and could you just give us a sentence, just think of anything you like and just say it to us.
Oh, let's see. Etse semikyun koplet e, which means the tail and the ears also speak. If you want to really understand what someone is saying, you can't just listen to the words, but you have to look at the body language as well.
Along with other constructed languages from fiction like Klingon from Star Trek or Dothraki from Game of Thrones, Na'vi is a fully working language you can learn to speak for yourself, which, it turns out, plenty of people have. Because, after all, even though there are thousands and thousands of languages on Earth, what connects them all is that they connect us to each other.
We have a community of fans of the movie and of the language who have embraced Na'vi to the point where they actually use it for real communication. There are people who are speaking it among themselves and really having, quite a lot of fun with it. At this point, perhaps we have a core group of perhaps 50 people who use the language on a pretty regular basis. And many of them actually speak it more fluently and write it more gracefully than I do.
Wow, I was going to ask you, actually, have you been surpassed by some of these people?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's not an inappropriate question for someone to ask, why would anyone want to devote so much energy and effort and time to learn essentially a created language rather than learning a language like, Spanish or Persian or Japanese or whatever? And there are a number of answers to that. One is community, that people have come together online with this one interest and have found friends. We've actually had two people come together online because of their shared interest in Na'vi, and they've actually gotten married. I have made lifelong friends through the people that have embraced the language, and it's been really a wonderful experience.
All that's left now is the credits, please, which would only be proper for us to hear in Na'vi.
Furia yune fitipenk oti aya ile irayo.
That's it for this week's Crowd Science on the BBC World Service. The question this week was from me, BK in the Philippines. The presenter was Anand Jagatia. and the producer was Rory Galloway. If you have a question for the team, please email it to crowdscience@bbc.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Salamat sa pagpaminaw. Bye!
Although it wasn't quite 7,000, we did hear lots of different languages in this show, including Ndebele,
Namhlanje isihloko esizaxoxa ngaso sithi
Shona,
inobva kuvanhu munyika dzese dziri pasirose, uye chinotsvaka nyanzvi dzinogona
Kikongo,
Basosa batu ya mbote, mbote
Swahili,
kipindi kinachopokea maswali kutoka kwa watu kote ulimwenguni
Finnish,
ya esitamme sinulle
Farsi
و بهترین مدارک دنیا پیدا میکنم.
اکن کفلوینا رو تسیل لایف مویاف کرد.
گجراتی.
آگار یکرم دنیا بھرنا مانسو پاسه تی.
گریک.
یک پو بی و خیت رو تیسی سپو آتوما اپولو تون کوزمو.
جاپنیز.
سنستمونی تایشی. سای ریو نا کتای و ارارر اکسپارتو ساگشیماز.
دینش.
فورسنگ ام کین الف اوکینا تلیرا. دینز تیما.
And Indonesian.
Masukan pertanyaan.
Thanks so much to all of the listeners and one producer that sent those in.